This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine and your host for Trumpet Hour. Canada elected a new prime minister on Monday. He's getting a lot of press for being a whole lot easier on the eyes than your average politician. But what are Justin Trudeau's politics? What are his ideas? And what does his election mean for Canada's future? The immigration crisis in Europe is creating an ugly backlash among Europeans who are frustrated and angry at this influx of Muslims. A lot of the socially progressive ideals that Europe has represented for the last couple of generations are being seriously challenged. The commitment to multiculturalism and tolerance, these become a lot harder to defend when you have foreigners flooding into your country and threatening to permanently change your way of life. Trumpet writer Brad McDonald says Europe is beginning to return to its past. The old demons are coming back, demons of xenophobia, of nationalism, demons that have been present in some of the worst, most violent chapters in Europe's history. We're going to talk to Brad McDonald about this trend. India is a nation on the rise. It's the world's second most populous nation. Its economy and its political clout are increasing. And it's making a major shift away from its Western orientation in recent decades toward friendships and alliances with its fellow Asian nations, fellow Asian giants, Russia and China in particular. Now, this represents a major change for India, one with significant geopolitical ramifications. We're going to look at what's happening with India and how it could help reshape the world. And we'll finish off the program today with a look at stimuli addiction, being too tapped into technology and hyperstimulation and what it costs us. All this on today's Trumpet Hour. On Monday, Canadians went to the polls to elect a new prime minister. It was a huge election. Canadians turned out in large numbers. More than 68% of the potential voters cast a ballot, highest turnout in more than two decades. The Liberals won big. This was a huge swing to the left in Canada. Liberals won 184 seats out of 338 seats up for grabs. Next closest party was Conservatives, which won only 99 seats. But the news that everyone is talking about is the new prime minister. The headline in the Mirror is Justin Trudeau the sexiest politician in the world? The article says Trudeau Jr. has luscious brown hair, spellbinding eyes, and eyebrows that we're reliably informed are, quote, entirely on point. Okay, but what about his political views? What does this mean for the direction of Canadian politics? Trumpet writer Robert Morley is here. He's been watching the politics in his native country. Robert, how you doing?
Great.
So a lot of Canadians are excited about Mr. Trudeau's spellbinding eyes. We need to talk about some aspects of this man that might give us a little better idea of how he might actually govern. First of all, what policies did he campaign on?
Well, I think you nailed it in the introduction. What we'll see in Canada now is, and what we have seen, is a big swing to the left in politics. And that really does just encompass a lot of areas, from the economy to foreign policy to domestic issues. And for Americans listening, the Liberal Party in Canada would probably be the version of the Democratic Party here in the United States. So they're very ideologically similar with the Democratic Party down here. But what happened in Canada in this election is the rise of the NDP, which is the New Democratic Party in Canada. And they are even farther left than the Liberals have been traditionally. And in the lead up to the election, the polls were neck and neck between the three parties, the NDP, the Liberals, and the Conservatives. And that's why many people were saying that this was a surprise victory for the Liberals. because they did come out with such a big majority in Canada. They have enough seats that they can govern by themselves. They don't need to make a coalition with any of the other parties. So whatever legislation they'd like to push through, they can do it. As long as they can keep their party together, they can do it. But getting back to your point of what we'll see in Canada, because the NDP did come on so strong, it pushed the whole spectrum of the debate to the left even further. And I think that's what we'll see going forward in Canada over the next 4 years.
Okay, so let's start by just examining some of the social policy, domestic policy that we would see coming out of this party, given the kind of power that they've just attained.
Right, absolutely. Probably one of the big things we'll see in Canada is the resurgence of multiculturalism, that policy in Canada. This was a campaign issue for Trudeau and Stephen Harper, in particular the issue with accepting migrants from the Middle East. Canada has made a name for itself as being the most open and welcoming country in the world. On a per capita basis, they already accept more migrants than any other nation in the world. And Stephen Harper got a lot of criticism for not accepting enough Syrian refugees or migrants. And Trudeau said as soon as he gets elected, he is immediately going to accept 25,000 additional Syrian refugees. And he says he's going to come up with the $100 million he says that they need to process them and get them into Canada within the next few months. And that contrasts very dramatically with Stephen Harper, who said that his plan would be to only accept an additional 10,000. He said that's what Canada can take, that's what Canada can handle, and that's the number we can process to make sure the people coming in are who they say they are. And he said that would take 4 years. So it was a very dramatic difference on the outlook of Canada. And Trudeau says we need to bring Canada more into the multicultural policies that his father first introduced to Canada back when he was elected back in the 1980s. So that's one area where we will look to see changes. As Trudeau has said, Canada needs to be even more culturally accepting than it is today.
Maybe you could just tell us a little bit more about his father. There's some people that are talking about Justin Trudeau Jr. as being really a continuation of a dynasty, and some are even comparing it to the Kennedys, that this is a family that has been in power. What did his father represent? How is he a continuation of that?
Right. So Justin Trudeau, his father, Pierre Trudeau, was a politician, very, very successful politician, governed Canada for 16 years back in the 70s up into the 80s, I think 1984, at that time period. And he really did radically changed Canada during his time. He was the prime minister that made multiculturalism a centerpiece in Canada. This idea that Canada is a nation for the world and that we should become kind of a representative of the world, have the same amount of nationalities in Canada as we find in the world, and we need to embrace migrants from countries that are not European, not Caucasian, just to basically be more equal or fair, however that policy is.
So would you say that was one of the pillar policies that he put in place? What else was he?
Absolutely. And another one was basically he made gave Quebec status as being a nation within Canada, essentially its own nation within Canada. It made French an official bilingual language in Canada, the official other language on par with English in Canada. You know, that's where all the law is stemming from in Canada. When you go and visit Canada and there's French on the milk box in Alberta, that's a result of his laws. Mm-hmm. So those are some of the two, probably the biggest impacts on social policy from Trudeau's time in office.
So the time since then, you mentioned, say, the conservatives and this just immigration, multiculturalism as being a major component of what people were voting for or against. So now we had a politician who was saying we need firmer borders, we need to be more concerned about preserving Canada, immigration policy needs to be tougher. Canadians said no. We've got to move more in the direction of the way that we were going.
Well, it appears that was at least a factor in it. And I think what Canada is starting to see is we do have a very large immigrant population, and those are votes as well. And that could be playing into some of these election results.
Okay, so moving on to economic policy, what can we expect to see coming up?
Yes. Well, he was very different than the outline or the visions promoted by Stephen Harper and then the NDP counterpart. He was the only leader of the three big parties in Canada that actually said specifically that he would not balance the budget over the next 3 or 4 years. He said that his plan was to boost the Canadian economy by going out and borrowing and spending in a range of more than $10 billion over each year, take Canada into the red, $10 billion a year under his plan to boost infrastructure spending, which he said would create jobs and get the economy going again. He doesn't have a plan for balancing the budget, but he says by 2019 or 2020, hopefully the economy is much better and the budget will balance itself essentially. So that's his big pillar was deficit spending on infrastructure to create jobs. He said he would help pay for it by increasing taxes on the wealthy. He said that the wealthy need to be paying a more fair share in Canada, and he wants to give the middle class a tax break. So as it works out, the numbers that he has proposed would be about a 4% tax hike on the wealthy, anybody making over $200,000 a year, 1.5% tax break on anybody making, I think, up to between $44,000 and $84,000 a year or something.
Similar type economic policy to what we see in the Democratic Party in the United States.
Very similar. Very similar. Raise taxes on the wealthy, boost spending. Let the budget sort itself out later.
And foreign policy?
Well, foreign policy is kind of interesting. His father wasn't a huge friend of Israel. Justin Trudeau, I think, has set himself up as a little bit, has shifted away a little bit from his father's stance. Stephen Harper, probably one of Israel's biggest friends it had currently on the political scene in the world. Justin Trudeau has made some statements very supportive of Israel, but he is probably, some statements also give the indication that he is more open to some of the Palestinian positions. So it'll be interesting to watch how that happens here. He also has been very strong pro-Israel in some ways. He's against the movement in universities to divest investments from Israel. He came out strong against some universities that had these rallies by Muslims that he compared to like apartheid, basically not allowing Jews around that area. And so he has come out very strong, and the Jewish community in Canada appears split on who they thought they should support. It seemed like most of them fell in through their support behind Harper's party, but it wasn't a clear-cut division in this case, from what I can tell.
What about, say, just military spending or the role of defense?
Yeah, great question. Well, liberals traditionally have been big spenders in Canada. But like the conservatives and the Democratic breakdown in the U.S., traditionally in Canada, the Conservative Party is more of the party of the bigger military spending. So we'll have to see how that goes.
You know, it's interesting. We've been talking on this program about, I guess it was last week we were talking to Richard Palmer about the global arms race and how really you have a almost universal trend among nations all over the world that are increasing their military spending, and you have really a significant break from that policy in the United States and Britain, where they're slashing spending, they're cutting back, and it just seems like there's a real divide between the nations of Europe, between the nations of Asia and the Middle East, and then these English-speaking nations. And we could kind of throw Canada in the same lot with America and Britain in this sense. And it seems like here politically, you're seeing a real shift to the right in European nations for many reasons, most recent of which is the immigration crisis. And here, this really dramatic break to the left happening in Canada is separate and distinct from what's happening elsewhere.
Right. When you asked me about military spending in Canada, my initial response as a Canadian was, what military spending? I don't want to disparage, what Canada has done. Under Stephen Harper, Canada's commitment to Afghanistan, the second largest contingent of troops over there, what we did in support of U.S. policy in Iraq. I mean, I think Canada committed in terms of resources and a percentage of its economy, huge numbers. And Canada really did go out of its way to support America and support the people of Iraq and Afghanistan. That said, Canada does have the benefit of living next door to the biggest superpower in the world that also happens to be its strongest ally in the world. So it does have the benefit of not having to contribute funding to its military the way that other nations have to. Hence all the jokes about Canada's Navy being consisting of an icebreaker or, you know, things along those lines.
Yeah. Well, it is it is just interesting looking at the overview of the world and how much we see this divide between these English-speaking countries and pretty much the entire rest of the world. And this just seems like more evidence of that trend. Well, we've been talking with trumpet writer Robert Morley. He's written an article. It's up on thetrumpet.com today. It's called What Trudeau's Election Teaches Us About Canadians. We appreciate you bringing this story to our attention.
You're more than welcome.
This is Trumpet Hour.
We've been watching the refugee crisis in Europe very closely. This is a real problem for many reasons in Europe. Muslim migrants flooding in, fleeing war-torn Syria, and there's a strong backlash in many European countries. Last week, we talked about the rise in neo-Nazism in Germany, which is taking in more immigrants than any other EU nation. Well, trumpet writer Brad McDonald is watching the situation. He's written an article for the coming issue of the Trumpet magazine. We're just finishing. This is our November-December issue. We're finishing up this week. And he says this is raising some fundamental questions about Europe's identity. So I have him here with me via Skype from our office in the UK. How are you, Brad?
I'm well, thank you.
So you talked about this on the Trumpet Daily on Monday. I wanted to get into a couple of additional ramifications of what's happening here that you discuss in this article. So you talk about how this is provoking an identity crisis. Can you summarize the point that you're making there?
Sure. Contemporary Europe can really be traced back to World War II, the conclusion of World War II, and the first 10 or 20 years after World War II. And in those years, the men and the nations and the governments, including America and Britain, when they rebuilt Europe, obviously America and Britain had to come together and not only finance the reconstruction of Europe, but also they were involved in the, let's say, the shaping and the molding of the European Union and resurrecting national governments across the continent. Anyway, when these post-war architects of Europe rebuilt the continent, their guiding principle obviously was, let's rebuild a continent that is not going to go to war like this again. Let's rebuild a continent where there's checks and balances. Let's create a system that really promotes cooperation and collaboration. Let's put higher moral values. Let's make them important. Let's make them of a paramount concern for Europeans. Let's make Europe multicultural. Let's make Europe tolerant. Let's make Europe a continent where all the countries want to work with a community spirit. And to some extent, and I suppose this can be debated, that Europe was created, and the European Union in particular has, or Europe has, in the last 70 years, it really has emerged as, let's say, the vanguard entity, or the entity at the vanguard of environmentalism or promoting a community spirit.
Several of the most liberal modern values that are so heavily promoted and celebrated among academicians and just people,
right,
that they're looking at a certain worldview, and Europe is kind of, and you even have, like, now you've got Bernie Sanders talking about, well, we need to look to Denmark, we need to look to Sweden,
yeah,
and some of these,
right,
these places.
Europe is progressive. Europe is sophisticated culturally, politically, its social systems, and that was all by design. And now what's happening with the influx of these refugees, and at the same time with Russia rising to the east and these different economic crises even in Europe, what's happening is Europeans are, you know, it's difficult to be multicultural, for example, when Muslims are moving into the house next door, or when you're watching thousands and thousands of Muslims from Syria disembarking from trains and some of them are waving the flags of ISIS. It's hard to be tolerant when you're watching that happen just a few miles away on your border. It's hard to be tolerant and accepting and welcoming when hundreds of thousands of refugees are arriving and they're expecting food and clothes and shelter and medical care, and they're expecting you to pay for it. So these values that Europeans hold dear to their hearts, Europeans are having a reality check now as they kind of come face to face with the harsh reality of taking care of hundreds of thousands of Muslims.
And essentially the point you said there, that Europeans hold these values dear to their hearts, but in a sense, it's a more recent embrace of some of these ideals. And the point that you make in the article is that what we've seen historically is very different than this, you know, the model that Europe has kind of been the been in the vanguard of more recently.
Right. Right. Yeah, it's I suppose it's close to their hearts in the sense that these are the views that they've been inclined to take for the past 60, 70 years. But if you go back and look at European history, and if really, it's not just the Europeans, it's the history of humanity. If you go back and look at the history of the Europeans, though, this is a continent where self-preservation, self-advancement, nationalism, all of these more, let's say, basic human proclivities really have had free reign. And that's what's happening now in Germany and in Europe. Europeans are, well, they're thinking less about being multicultural and tolerant, and they're thinking more about protecting the self, protecting their community, protecting their family, protecting their culture, protecting their economy. And that just breeds, you know, that breeds friction, that breeds uncertainty, that breeds tension between the Europeans and the migrants that are coming in. And what it's doing is it's kind of refashioning Europe into this old Europe. Europe's demons of the past, you could say, are coming back.
It's basically realities that are causing and forcing Europeans to challenge some of those more abstract ideals.
Right.
If you say multiculturalism is great until you're face to face with someone who's basically trying to force their culture down your throat, and then you say, well, now wait a minute, this isn't
right.
working.
Right, right. That's happening increasingly across Europe. It's happening in particular in certain pockets, in particular in Bavaria, in southern Germany, in Austria, in Slovenia and Hungary. You know, it's happening where there are hundreds of thousands of refugees settling, but it's going to happen more and more, I think, across the whole continent.
This is something that we've talked about for a long time: the Islamization of Europe, and just how much there is basically a cultural crisis and a clash of civilizations developing on the European continent. You know, this is a story that's been developing over a period of, well, really probably a decade and a half or more. I have an article here by Selwyn Duke. This was in the New American. And he says, many of us have heard the stories, German schoolgirls being told to wear, quote, modest Sharia-compliant clothing to avoid offending the Muslims, migrants turning their free housing into a garbage dump, attacking medical staff, becoming enraged at having to pay for prescriptions, suing the German government for not paying benefits fast enough, German schoolchildren asked to make beds and cook for able-bodied migrants. This is almost like this really is Muslims forcing their way of doing things on Europeans who are not particularly excited about that. And it seems like in some ways the migrant crisis is accelerating the pace of that trend to such a speed that it's forcing Germans and Europeans more broadly to respond more aggressively, more like we've got to do something about this right now.
Right. And I think the reason there's such an urgency attached to it right now is because well, this year, 1.5 million refugees are going to arrive in Germany. This idea of Muslims settling in Europe, you know, that's certainly not original. France has huge pockets of Muslims. I think there's a couple of 2 to 3 million Turkish people in Germany. So these pockets of Muslims are all through Europe, even to the point where there are communities or there are suburbs within cities where Sharia law is the predominant law, where you know native Germans or native Frenchmen shouldn't visit. That's been going on, or that's been building for the past 2 or 3 decades. But what's happening now is all of a sudden we're looking at the arrival of 1 to 2 million more Muslims all at once. And these people are, you know, they're flocking or they want to go to these areas that already exist that are Muslim. So it's just this I think it's brought to the fore, or it's just shocked a lot of European or made a lot of Europeans aware of a problem that has actually been there for quite a while now.
A point that you make in your article that backs up your overarching point is what we're seeing with many of these European nations that are essentially they're prioritizing their national interests and even putting national policy over and above European policy. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Right. Well, that's just a really interesting angle to this whole story. The European Union is just built on this concept of promoting unity and integration in Europe. And EU proponents want more unity, more collaboration, more integration. But for the EU to become more united, the sovereign nations of Europe have to relinquish power and control of their politics, of their economies, of their borders even. And with this refugee crisis, for example, one of the pillar tenets of the European Union is being questioned. One of the pillar tenets of the European Union is the free movement of people between the EU countries. So if you travel around Europe today, you don't have to show your passport as you go from country to country. There's no border stops, no border checks. And all of that was formalized with the Schengen Agreement. I think it was in 1985. And under the Schengen Agreement, people and goods could travel freely through the member nations of the EU. But now with the arrival of all of these refugees, a number of countries, Hungary, Slovenia, Austria, even Germany, they're talking about and they've actually imposed border controls. And in one or two cases, they've closed down the border. So EU policy says the border has to be open and there are not to be any border controls. But the reality of the refugee crisis has forced some countries to impose border controls and even to close down the border. So it just raises this fundamental question. You know, what is the EU if its member states don't respect its fundamental principles?
Yeah, so this is a really interesting angle because we're seeing really two opposing forces at work here. In one sense, it seems likely that Europe would unite against this common threat, and there would be a tendency to we need to kind of bunker down, work together, and expel this this force that's overtaking us, and that would play more toward a unification among European governments and European nations. And on the other hand, and that's of course something that we've been expecting to see for decades, where we know that biblical prophecy tells us that Europe is going to unite. And the way that this is unfolding here, it's not difficult to see how it would really accelerate that process and could even do so like overnight. You could have a major, say, unification among European countries and European thinking. And then on the other hand, you have this counter force that is erecting the fences, and people are bunkering down just within their nation and saying, okay, well, the EU-wide policies aren't working. We've got to look after our own.
Right.
How do you see those two forces playing out?
I love the fact that there seems to be two contradicting forces at work here. And the reason is because that reality is taken into account even in the Bible prophecies that we use to show that Europe is going to unite. If we go back to the Daniel 2 image, and if we look at the feet that represent the seventh resurrection of the Holy Roman Empire, which the Bible prophesies, and if we look at the composition of those feet, it's a composition of iron and clay. These two very different materials, they're united, but it's a fractious integration. It's a short-lived. Mr. Armstrong mentioned this a number of times when he was talking about the final resurrection of this European empire. He said it would be short-lived. Bible prophecy says that it's going to be fractious. There's going to be issues that they don't agree on, but they're going to come together for a short period of time. And I think, you know, as you suggested, they're going to unite for this short moment to confront some of these threats. You know, you look at what Russia is doing in Ukraine and even in Syria and the Middle East. That is reason for Europe to unite. You look at what's happening with the refugee crisis, and there is more unification happening at an EU level to solve this refugee crisis. I read an article yesterday that made the point that we're moving very quickly towards the establishment of an EU military. And part of the reason EU leaders want an integrated military, or they want to integrate Europe's militaries, is so they can go into the Mediterranean and they can start to solve or stop the flow of refugees into Europe. So the Bible amazingly, incredibly takes into account this apparent contradiction.
So for us to recognize, say, this reversion to historical form within Europe, which really has been a very conflicted, very bloody history with a lot of warfare between and among European nations, but often dominated by a single force that subjugated those or pulled those together for a short amount of time, that was able to unify those various competing entities within Europe into a single empire, a single force for a short amount of time, repeatedly throughout history. Essentially, what we're seeing today, all of the elements are there for exactly that same kind of history to unfold another time.
Absolutely. And most notably, the main element that's still there is human nature. Just going back to where we started from, the Europeans, despite their sophisticated morality, despite how much they love the earth and how anti-war they are and how tolerant and multicultural they are, the European people, like all of us, have this human nature that says, protect the self, protect my family, protect my country. That hasn't been taken away, and that is what we're seeing reemerge in Europe.
Thanks for your insights, Brad. The article that you've written, Europe's Old Demons Are Returning, this is something that as we're putting this November-December issue of The Trumpet together, we should be able to see that there in the print edition, and it'll appear online on thetrumpet.com soon. We sure appreciate your time.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
The world's second most populous nation, with over 1.2 billion people, is India. It's a nuclear power. It has the third largest standing army in the world. It's a top 10 economy in the world. And recently, its political alignment has been shifting. It's becoming friendlier with Russia and China. And this is a trend that the Trumpet has been watching for many years. I have Jeremiah Jacques here to tell us about the most recent developments and to talk about how significant this is to the world ahead. Hello, Jeremiah.
Hello there.
So we talked a little bit last Friday about these recent military exercises with China. Why don't you start by just talking a little bit about that?
Okay, sure. Yeah, on October 12th last week, the Chinese Army, which is the People's Liberation Army, and the Indian Army conducted a session of joint counterterrorism drills. These were codenamed Hand in Hand 2015 drills, and it was the fifth of such joint exercises that the two nations have held since 2007. And it's a pretty significant development because the historic relationship between India and China has been very tense. A lot of border disputes, even full-out war from time to time over the border there. And it's just been a history that's full of competition and just fraught with all kinds of tension. So these drills are still small in a sense, but they do signal a thaw in that relationship. And it's not because India and China have resolved their differences, but it's because now I believe they share a common Western, anti-Western ideology that sort of trumps the disagreements that they have with each other.
Let's just talk about India's prime minister. How much is this man responsible for this shift and, say, this anti-Western ideology that you're talking about?
I think he's responsible for quite a bit of it. Some parts of this thaw were happening before he came into office, but it is accelerating.
Just tell us about him when he came into office and kind of what his orientation is.
Sure. Yeah, he was elected in May of 2014. It was actually the result of the world's largest vote in history, in mankind's history. There were 800 million ballots cast. And so India's Bharatiya Janata Party won a landslide victory as a result of that massive election. And Narendra Modi was the head of that party. So he came into power with the first absolute majority in India's lower house of parliament in over 30 years. So that gives him powers that his predecessors could only have dreamed of, having an absolute majority there. And if you go back a little bit and you look at the history of this man, Narendra Modi, back in 2005, the United States revoked his visa on grounds that he had played a role in one of India's bloodiest episodes of religious violence. The violence had taken place in the state where Modi was the chief minister at the time. A lot of Hindu riders there killed more than 1,200 Muslims, and they forced another 150,000 Muslims to flee their homes. And so Modi was accused of both encouraging the violence and of failing to stop it. And even though his involvement was never proven, the United States slapped some serious sanctions on him, and the European Union quickly followed suit. And so ever since then, Modi responded to that Western snub by really looking toward the East. He has been making friends and forging alliances with Russia especially, but also with Japan and China and other Asian nations. And I think it's pretty interesting that shortly after he was elected, the South China Morning Post came out and just talked about how that election of Narendra Modi in India really represented a black eye for the United States and a real boon for the Eastern powers. I just want to read a short quote of that article. This is a Chinese paper. It said, "Modi is also known to have an Eastern bias, with Asian nationalism forming the core of his worldview. Apart from China, that also draws him closer to Japan and Singapore, with whose leaders he has struck up a similar rapport. Modi's unimpeachable conservative background and open admiration for China has in the past raised hopes of him becoming a sort of Indian Richard Nixon." And Nixon is not the only world leader that Modi has been compared to. The Diplomat has called him India's Shinzo Abe. That's the Prime Minister of Japan, very hawkish, very conservative. India's Economic Times likened him to Xi Jinping, the President of China, who's also very conservative. He's consolidated more power than any Chinese leader in recent memory. And then One Indian News kind of skipped to the chase and likened Modi to Asia's big man himself, Vladimir Putin, and just said he is India's Putin. So a lot of people see his nationalism. They see his heavy-handed leadership. And they just see that he has a similar Putin-like capability to change India into a real military and economic powerhouse.
So he's really behind a lot of this shift. Well, of course, the people that elected him, that represents a change in Indian thinking as well. But at the same time that you have this political shift and this orientation toward other Asian giants, India is really increasing and it's growing in its stature and its power and its capacity. Can you give us a sense of just what's happening in India and its importance, its rising importance within the region, and why a shift in India's politics would be so significant?
Yes. Yeah, sure. Back at the end of the Cold War, there in the late 80s, early 90s, India's GDP was $274.8 billion. Not too bad. But then by 2014, it was over $2 trillion. That's the seventh largest in the world. And by this year, India has become the world's fastest growing large economy. And it's set to just keep on and on growing. Christopher Wood, a strategist this year, said that India is the most promising story in Asia on a 5 to 10 year review. And it said that that's largely because Mr. Modi is so pro-business, so pro-investment. And Christopher Wood actually called him the most pro-business political leader in the world. And then also alongside this astounding economic growth, you have more focus on military power. And so from the year 2004 until 2009, India's military expenditure increased by 45%. And India imported, just in 2009 alone, it imported $200 million worth of military equipment only from the United States. And it gets even more of its military hardware from Russia than it does from the U.S. And then by 2013, that figure had risen to $2 billion. So it's very, very quickly expanding what it spends on defense. Its population is just staggering, close to 1.2 billion now. That's the second most populous in the world. And it is quickly modernizing and just continuing to build up every aspect of its military.
So this would really add considerable heft to an Asian alliance, which we've been talking a lot about the alliance developing between Russia and China, which is really concerning for a lot of reasons, but to add India to the mix really changes the picture considerably.
It does. It really does. The Bible makes clear that in the end time, the Asian nations will form an army of no fewer than 200 million men. So that's just a staggering number. It's hard to even wrap your mind around it. But once you combine the populations of China and India, and then throw Russia in there too, although it's not nearly as populous, it's very easy to see how such a massive, gargantuan army could come from an alliance of those nations.
Now, it's interesting. India, obviously part of the British Empire, still part of the British Commonwealth, but its history with these great Asian powers actually goes back even further than that. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, sure. Starting all the way back in the 1600s, Indian merchants were regularly crossing into Russia, and they were building the very early foundations of the modern-day Russo-Indian relationship. So by the 18th century, Indian traders were living not only in Russia's southern cities, but as far north as Moscow, Kazan, and St. Petersburg. And many of them were becoming assimilated. And so it really looked at that time as if the peoples of India and Russia were on course to build a very lasting bond. But then came the British. The British colonized India in 1858, and the Russians were never happy about that British colonization. It was really at the expense of the Indian-Russian friendship that had been building there. And so the Russians made no attempt to downplay their desire to see the British pushed out of India. Here's one quote. This is from Vladimir Lenin. He became the leader of the Soviet Union. And in 1918, he said, There can be no general peace without a free, independent India. We Russian revolutionaries and international socialists feel it our duty to rejoice at the announcement of a revolution in India, but also to support this revolution by direct or indirect means with all our powers. And Mahatma Gandhi, who was the primary architect of India's independence movement, he acknowledged Russia and its revolution as a huge source of inspiration to him. Here's a quote from Gandhi. He said, "We too can resort to the Russian remedy against tyranny. Our shackles will break this very day if the people of India become united and patient and love their country and think of the well-being of their motherland, disregarding their self-interest. We also can show the same strength that the Russian people have done." So that was shortly after the Russian Revolution there. And he said, look, India, we need to do the same thing against the British. We need to cast off the British yoke. Here's another short quote from Gandhi. He said, "Bolshevik ideals, sanctified by the sacrifice of such master spirits as Lenin, cannot go in vain." We often think of Gandhi as a peacemaker and a pacifist, and I think, you know, some of his ideology is commendable, but the fact that he was drawing so much inspiration from some of these Russian revolutionaries who, you know, ended up becoming the designers of that Soviet system that was so oppressive and so brutal against the people of Russia, it just shows that there's some darkness on that Indian independence movement, I think, and on Gandhi's leadership as well.
It's interesting. Earlier in the program, we were talking to Brad McDonald about the reversion to historical form that we're seeing in Europe, and how they've been essentially going through this experiment in modernization, in liberalization of some of their social ideals, embracing multiculturalism and this type of thing. But essentially what we're seeing now is return to what has been more the historical norm in Europe, which is a much more militaristic type of history. And in a sense, you have a somewhat parallel situation happening in India, in the sense that you can really view British influence, British alliance with India as more of a historical anomaly. And what's happening now is really a reversion to what you saw before Britain entered the picture and India beginning to take on more of an orientation that is in keeping with its history, that is more Asian-centric.
That's exactly right. I think that the period of British rule, I mean, that left a deep impression on India, which will always be there, I believe. It was a fundamental change for India, mostly positive, I believe. But it was, in many ways, an anomaly, like you said. And now India is quickly becoming much more Eastern-oriented. I think a huge indication of this that we saw was after Russia's annexation of Crimea there in 2014. It was hoped by President Obama that the whole world would, you know, condemn Russia's annexation. And he even said the international community stands against Russia. But that wasn't true. India and China both came out and they showed their support for Russia's annexation of the Crimean Peninsula. So that single event showed a very deep fault line emerging between East and West. You know, you've got China and Russia and India there saying it's okay, and then you have Russia and the U.S. on the other side saying that's not okay.
Very interesting. And of course, you mentioned earlier about just how this fits in with biblical prophecy, the fact that we are expecting this Asian alliance, particularly a military alliance that is able to post the largest standing army in history. But this prophecy of the kings of the East, just more and more evidence of Russia and China being joined by this Indian behemoth and adding a lot of heft and a lot of power to that Asian alliance, something that we do need to keep watching for in the time ahead. We've been talking with trumpet writer Jeremiah Jacques. He's written an article called Asia's Other Powerhouse. It's going to be appearing on thetrumpet.com tomorrow. That's Thursday. So you can watch for that article there. Jeremiah, a lot of interesting information to keep our eyes on here. We appreciate you bringing us this information.
Thanks for having me.
It's time for today's last word.
Modern life moves at mighty speed. Our food is fast. Our internet connections are fast. We tweet, we text, we upgrade. We work overtime to stay ahead of the competition. We're on the go. Even when we watch television, we watch Criminal Minds and Grey's Anatomy, shows with people who are quick-witted, fast-moving, and stressed out. The rat race has never been so brisk. But we adapt, we multitask, we power nap, we spend quality time with each other instead of quantity. That's the way it has to be, isn't it? Or is it possible we're making life too hard for ourselves? Maybe we're simply becoming addicted to stimulation. Consider life before television, radio, telephone, even telegraph. It wasn't that long ago. News generally traveled by foot or hoof. Intercontinental travel took days or weeks. The pace was slow and the world was huge. Today, journalists are in every nook of the planet reporting continually. The nightly news promises the world in 22 minutes. If you can't wait for that, cable provides headline news with multiple bits of information flashing and scrolling simultaneously. The internet lets us scan only the headlines. Twitter gives us everything we need in 140 characters. There is so much going on, we only want the essential, only the surface. Speed is of the essence. With satellite TV, the internet, mobile devices, tablets, laptops, DVDs, iPods, radio, video games, there's always something to keep us stimulated. Soon we crave the hyperstimulation. We can only take so much of plain old life. Is it any wonder we're rearing a hyper ADHD generation? There may be a problem here, but we're moving too fast to pin it down. Let's slow down for a moment. Think about it. What price are we paying for our short attention spans, our compulsive hyperness? Well, the price we pay is depth. We give up depth in our relationships, depth in our emotions, depth in our thoughts. We think we have wisdom when we merely have information. We think that living under the same roof is the same as being a family. Years ago, there was a study on father-child interaction. Researchers first asked a group of middle-class fathers to estimate how much time they spent each day with their one-year-old children. The average reply was 15 to 20 minutes. Then they used methods to determine the actual amount, and they discovered the average time was really 37 seconds. 2.7 encounters each day, 10 to 15 seconds each. Now, we might shake our heads and wonder, well, how can they do that to those kids? But I know that if the fathers in that study read the statistic in the paper, they'd think the same thing. Yeah, I should spend more time with my kids, but at least I'm getting a good 15 to 20 minutes a day. That's a whole lot better than those 37-second dads. And then after a moment's musing on the matter, they would turn the page and move on. There's a vicious cycle at work. Stimuli addiction is both a cause of our shallowness and a symptom of it. It's hard to break free of something so enthralling, so easy, so everywhere. Depth is too hard. Depth is discovering one great book and sitting down with it, getting to know it, really studying it, letting it soak into your life. Instead, we load up the bookshelf with books we only skim. Is this really a problem? Well, think about it. Stimulation overdose eventually creates numbness. That is, nothing stands out in the cacophony for longer than a moment. Too much noise becomes white noise, like static on an empty television channel. How then can God reach our minds in a lasting way? God, the epitome of depth, of substance, of balance, of quiet meditation, of timelessness, of moral perfection, of everything opposite our shallowness. Even nightmarish tragedies, terrorist attacks, natural disasters, these can shrink to insignificance amid the bustle. Our minds quickly absorb events, and then we move on. After the devastation of the September 11th, 2001, terrorist attacks, church attendance spiked, but then it was back to pre-9/11 levels within 3 weeks. In Matthew 13, there's a parable showing what happens when God sows his word. Some of it is snatched up by the devil. Some people are too shallow to receive. Some people are too addicted to the world to hold on to it. This parable has special poignancy in a world jacked up on caffeinated culture. Scripture calls God a voice crying in the wilderness today. Is your life quiet enough for you to hear him? Don't answer too quickly. Stop and think a while. I'm Joel Hilliker, and we're coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. This program is the voice of the Trumpet magazine. You can find us online at thetrumpet.com. That's where to find the stories we talked about on this program. That's where you can also go to get a free subscription to this monthly news magazine, the Philadelphia Trumpet. We'd like to hear from you. Send us any comments or questions by emailing letters@thetrumpet.com. I want to thank my guests today, Robert Morley, Brad McDonald, and Jeremiah Jacques. Also, thanks to our technical staff, Dwight Falk and Abraham Blondeau. I'll leave you with this thought from Dwight D. Eisenhower. When you are in any contest, you should work as if there were, to the very last minute, a chance to lose it. This is battle. This is politics. This is anything. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. It's been a pleasure. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on The Voice, 101.3 KPCG, and on the web at kpcg.fm.